This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Friday, March the 15th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. Joining me in studio today, Cormac McQuinn and Jennifer Bray. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
We're recording a little bit earlier than usual this morning. What's on the agenda this week? We will talk a little bit later about the continuing fallout from the referendum last weekend, upcoming clashes, arguably within Cabinet, on immigration policy. But first of all, it is March the 15th. It is 2 days to St. Patrick's Day, where Irishness seems to get celebrated around the world, perhaps celebrated more around the world than it does in Ireland, Cormac, particularly by those aforementioned cabinet ministers who are scattered to the four corners of the earth as we speak.
It's that weekend where Paddy Wackery takes over, isn't it? The government love this week every year. This is the biggest St. Patrick's Day mission ever. They're in 47 odd countries, I think there is 38 government representatives and other politicians like Count Corla or non-politicians like the Attorney General. They're all around the world. Obviously,
it is a bit weird, isn't it? Other countries don't do this.
They don't, but maybe they would if they had the chance. For all the pageantry and the silliness of Bulls of Shamrock and, marching in St. Patrick's Day parades and far-flung places, there is the access that's gotten. I was surveying who's gone where this week, and aside from the obvious, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, is having his meeting with Joe Biden in the Oval Office today. Tánaiste Micheál Martin's meeting Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today. Michael McGrath, the Minister of Finance, is in China. He's meeting his counterpart.
One wonders what St. Patrick's Day actually means in China.
Well, this is it, but it obviously means something because he has that access, But access for a country the size of Ireland, which is kind of the population of a small Chinese city, I would wonder how often the Communist Party administrators of such cities get to meet their finance minister, So there is that side of it. This year it's been a bit, I suppose, overshadowed in terms of, they like this to be a kind of a happy clappy thing and promoting trade and meeting the diaspora. It's been a bit overshadowed by the pressure on the government to raise Gaza and the situation there everywhere they go, particularly in the White House, given the support of the US administration for Israel through funding and arms trade and all of that. Leo Varadkar is supposed to be leading that push to put across Ireland's position that this has gone on too long. He gave a very strong speech in Boston at the start of the week where he was saying that something along the lines of the cries of children will haunt us forever if we don't put an end to this. It will be raised in his meeting today with Joe Biden, albeit it's at a time where you would detect that the US is getting a bit uncomfortable about how things have gone in Gaza with 30 plus thousand people killed. You have, even in the last 24 hours, a very senior senator, Chuck Schumer, Democrat, Jewish senator, being openly critical of the Benjamin Netanyahu government in
Basically
Israel.
Saying it's time to get rid of
Netanyahu. Yeah, it's almost suggesting regime change. Now, at the same time, he's obviously criticising Hamas as well, and he's also saying that it's time for Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority to go as well. But those sort of comments from a very senior US senator are unprecedented, really. Timing is not necessarily bad. It's this, the Irish call for an immediate ceasefire, which has been in place for months now. It's the timing of it now, where the US is moving towards a position where they're very concerned about what is going on in Gaza. It's not a bad time to be having that word with Joe Biden in the Oval Office.
Yeah, that's true. There's a certain amount of slow repositioning happening in the Democratic Party side. Obviously, at the moment, Jennifer, Joe Biden has obviously the challenge for presidential election ahead, and there's some possibility that, strong feelings over Gaza may play into that. I do think about the St. Patrick's Day thing. In my opinion, St. Patrick's Day is an American invention in the first place, or an American-Irish invention. So America always looms. I'm sure the Chinese visit is important and all that kind of stuff, but America looms much larger. And then, given the fact that Ireland's position in Gaza is not an outlier, but it's on one side of where the EU, the spectrum of EU opinions, and it's probably well ahead or well separate from mainstream American opinion, it is a political challenge for a Taoiseach you know, who likes to go over there with the bowl of shamrock, say, Turralurralurra, we all love each other, to actually bring up this horrendous human rights catastrophe which is happening at the moment, and which I think it's fair to say the majority of Irish people think that America bears some responsibility for.
Definitely. He has kind of, Leo Varadkar, that is, he has an interesting, I suppose, line to walk. I mean, it is worth comparing what he said earlier in the week as in Boston. This is at the JFK Library, and this is the speech that Cormac mentioned there. And I'll give you a few quotes from that just to compare it to the speech then that he gave at the Ireland Funds Dinner, which would be a very different audience, you know, power brokers and whatnot. So when he was in Boston, he said, Boston, like the way I said Boston there?
Very good. Like that,
When he was in Boston, he said, the cries of the innocent will haunt us forever if we stay silent. The cries will engender more retaliation and beget more violence and revenge. No child ever gave their consent for terrorist acts. No child should ever be punished for them. And he went on to talk about how it's unconscionable that they're dying because of the relentless bombing and destruction and hunger and thirst and the absence of medical treatment and care. And it was really hard-hitting language, and it made headlines obviously here, but also all across America and beyond. And that room was kind of filled with sort of a very Irish-friendly crowd, you know, like Irish-American Democrats, you know. And then a couple of days later, he went on to the Ireland Funds Dinner, which I mentioned. I've been to that event before. It's kind of packed with all your kind of Nancy Pelosi's and basically lawmakers. And I think it's a harder crowd for him to play to. And I think he did tone down his language. I mean, I'll give you some quotes from that. He's talked about how the brutal and indiscriminate attacks carried out by Hamas on Israeli civilians were vicious terrorist crimes and atrocities. As we sit here tonight in this wonderful building, Palestinian civilians who are not responsible for the crimes of Hamas are being subjected to humiliation and starvation. And they're strong words, but they're nowhere near as strong as the kind of this message of us being haunted. It was put to Leo Varadkar that he was toning down his language. And he said, he said no, and then he did say that he does tailor, you have to tailor the message that you're delivering depending on the audience who you're with. And while I think that's reasonable, it did lead to questions about how exactly are you going to phrase this when you meet with Biden? Cormac mentioned that later today. He said he will still, he won't be deflected. He'll still bring that message that, you know, Ireland's calling for a ceasefire. But I do think it shows, I think it shows how interesting that role of Taoiseach is when you're abroad. And opposition parties, and I actually sometimes very fairly say, you know, you should have one unequivocal line, and that if they were there, if they were the Taoiseach, they'd do this, that and the other. But I wonder, would they?
Well, one of the things I wonder is the main opposition party is obviously Sinn Féin. They've been critical of the government's positioning on this, but Sinn Féin have a very high profile in the United States as well. And what exactly are they saying over there, I wonder?
Yeah, Michelle O'Neill's speech then, the same Ireland Funds dinner, Sinn Féin were also questioned afterwards and said, you know, even Sinn Féin's contribution during that dinner is nowhere near as, you know, strident as they would normally be. So I think they too are moderating their language depending on the crowd that they're with. And I think even when Leo Varadkar mentioned at the Isle of Ones dinner about the situation in Palestine, it was kind of a lukewarm applause. The journalists who were there reported that.
And this would be a cross-party, an all-party meeting. So there'd be plenty of Republicans as well as Democrats. You're not in the heartland of Democratic Irish America in Boston here. It's a different kind
there'd
of
be both.
Setup.
And then when he mentioned Ukraine and the situation in Ukraine in the same speech, there was a much more enthusiastic applause. And it shows that Leo Varadkar is, we know, like, obviously America, the situation with Israel, the fact that, you know, on one hand they're supplying munitions and, you know, artillery, all that kind of stuff, and on the other hand they're giving aid to Gazans. You know, there's that kind of duality, and for him I think it's a difficult message for him to sell when America has up to a certain point been very pro-Israel, and he's trying to walk that tightrope. But there was one comment that really stuck out for me, which I think will go down really badly, both amongst people in Fine Gael and in the wider political system. And it was just a kind of passing thing. He said, I think Joe Biden's heart is in the right place. It's just one comment, but we know we live in an age where people do pick up on one comment, whether it's in a headline or otherwise. Unfortunately, this is the way it is. And I think that kind of tanked. I don't think people would appreciate a comment like that in Ireland, knowing how strongly and pro-Palestine a lot of the country has been for many years.
But also, his heart's in the right place, but Joe Biden could do something about this.
Exactly.
You know, that's the, like, but what I thought was interesting was it's kind of the Gaza issue is kind of impinging even on the kind of the more supposedly happy, clappy parts of the St. Patrick's Day missions. We had Catherine Martin going to the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, which she was challenged
about. The largest gathering of hipsters in the world,
absolutely,
I think.
Yeah. All of the Irish artists due to participate pulled out, and there was pressure on her to do the same. Now, she insisted she still had to go because she was promoting the Irish arts industry and film industry and all of that, you know, but then also had very pointedly released a speech she delivered during the trip on outlining her revulsion and what's going on in Gaza, you know. So it's the minister for fun, although God knows her job hasn't been that much fun lately, no. But it's impacting on her her mission as well.
She's having even less fun. I mean, is the suggestion here that Ireland should, you know, officially boycott the United States? Is that what we're talking about?
That has been suggested by opposition politicians that,
very few opposition politicians.
Well, we know the SDLP didn't send. Claire Hannah has said, they view it as being a great big party.
Shutting down Facebook, you know, saying goodbye to Pfizer.
That's never going to happen.
Well, indeed. Our cash codes. I just wonder, where does it, I mean, it's one thing.
The other thing is, there's an interesting split in the White House events this week, which hasn't occurred in previous years, which might actually aid the awkwardness of challenging Biden on Gaza, however gently, and doing the Paddy Wackery aspect of it, because the Taoiseach is meeting Biden today in the Oval Office, which is where the substantive chats happen. You know, the big issues get discussed. But usually, then later in the day, there's a reception in the White House where there's traditional Irish music and drinks, and the shamrock is handed over. That's actually not happening until Sunday. So it might actually work in Taoiseach's favour.
So it's a little confusing. There's the meeting and there's the shamrock thing.
Yes.
So there's two meetings, but only one of them where they actually exchange more than...
Usually they have the meeting kind of midday in the Oval Office. They go off to Capitol Hill, glad hand all the senators and Congress people up there, and then come back to the White House later that day. But that's not that
and
second
have the meeting
White
in
House.
The Oval Office then, and that's when, as a journalist, you are risking getting whiplash trying to get your space in the scrum.
It is crazy because everyone rushes in and tries to get a good spot around the couches. But it's not just the Irish journalists; it's the American pool reporters as well, who don't have as much access as they would like to the president. So they're yelling at, in my case when I was there, was Trump. They're yelling at Trump. We're yelling at Trump. He's just sitting there. I mean, in my the year I went, he just went on a big rant about how unfair EU trade policy was, and Varadkar was sitting there like I don't know, like a plank.
Was that the year when he was talking about you've got a fine border? It's like, oh my God, please.
I'm not sure it was that year, but it's chaos, that whole experience.
So you've both had that. You've both done that gig. It's memorable. It looks memorable.
It is brilliant. I was there for Obama and for Trump. I think twice with Trump and once on the Obama administration. It's exhausting. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, it's really early mornings. There's a lot of watching people eating. Like, you need to pack your bag with protein bars or you're
going to
starve.
He was complaining about this, that it basically involves standing behind a kind of a fence with all these other animals from the press, just watching people tuck into their
dinner. There's also, I think I mentioned this on this podcast last year or the year before, there's kind of this mortifying thing. I think it's mortifying, but I still did it because, you know, whatever, why not be cringe? But when you go into, you know, the press, the American press room, and you stand up at the...
I did this too.
At the podium and you get your picture and all the American journalists are looking at you like,
rolling
their
eyes.
God.
Oh my God, so you're the equivalent of the American tourist in Ireland. That's the equivalent of kissing the Blarney Stone, is it?
Yeah,
there
was once where it coincided, you know, where we went on to New York afterwards and went and celebrated Paddy's Day and all the guards were out. You made a comment that actually St. Patrick's Day is an American creation. Mm. I've celebrated St. Patrick's Day here in Ireland and in America, and the hangovers are worse in America. They take that, like, they take it really, really seriously.
They take it more seriously than we do.
They go hard.
Fair play to them and Aaron Gabra and all the rest of it. Obviously, one of the effects of this is that the entire government... is there somebody left behind? Do we have a caretaker who is effectively the entire Irish government at the moment?
There's always one
gone?
Person. One minister is always left
behind. I don't know who it is, though.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're making a massive impact. Yeah. They're seizing the moment.
Clearly, they've changed it. They've seized the reins of power and everything will be
designated
different
when
everybody, else gets back. Yeah. But it marks a kind of an end point to a subject I know you're thoroughly sick of, Jennifer, which is the two referendums, it was only a week ago that everybody was voting. It was only 6 days ago that you were trapped in Dublin Castle for how long? How many hours?
I was going to stay for the announcement of the last vote, and then Pat rang me and he was like, you can just simply watch it online. So this was like 9:30 or whatever, so or 9 o'clock, so I went home. So,
so
I think I was
there for about 12 hours or so. Or
yeah, but you, look, I'm not going to, you know, I love that kind of stuff. Yeah. It was more the day after when I was like, what?
Was the match on TV down there?
It was, but I didn't get a chance to watch it. And I'm glad I didn't, because I would have been devastated at the dropkick at the end. That would have wrecked my, that would have ruined my day.
Yeah, well, they would have got the penalty anyway. So, you know, console yourself with that.
True, true.
Definitively, though, is it all over now, including the shouting? Or is there any...
No.
I mean, our lead story today by Arthur Beasley is very interesting about information which is now coming out about the advice which the government received from various government departments in advance of the referendum on what the wording should be.
So I was going to mention this, actually. No, it's not over. And, you know, I think it's in some ways it's better for the government that there was a recess, the Dáil's in recess this week, because then a lot of the shouting, you know... wouldn't have, but then it's difficult as well because so many of the opposition parties backed it, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But anyway.
So is there a kind of a tumbleweed blowing through the corridors thing, even apart from the fact that people are away, that, you know, nearly everybody in the Dáil, bar maybe a kind of 10 or so senators and TDs, they were signed up for this, some of them a bit reluctantly, but they did go along with it.
Well, yeah, but now we've learned that there are people in government, or whether it be they be senators or otherwise, who voted no despite being out canvassing yes, which is...
That's kind of unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, we've always known that shy voters is a phenomenon, but we never knew they were actually members of the government.
And know? I wonder, is this because... Right, let's take Lisa Chambers as an example. She talked about kind of changing her mind despite canvassing yes early on. She was on Instagram then a couple of days ago, and she did a very short video, and she asked people to give her feedback about why they voted no. And it was really interesting. I was reading through the comments, and she left a response in one of the comments, and she said that she agreed with someone who kind of was talking about why they voted no. And she said, despite the good intentions, it just wasn't progressive enough. Now, I'm actually not accusing Lisa Chambers of this specifically, because I don't think that she's a cynical politician. But I do think that there are others in politics maybe who came out and said that they voted no, because that's almost being on the right side of history and being like, well, I actually agreed with you guys. Please don't give me a kicking in my next election campaign or whatever. There is a part in me that wonders, are they now going, oh God, we're so far on the wrong side of this, given the fact it was the highest ever percentage no vote in terms of the care thing.
Still a low enough turnout, though. Most people didn't care
at all. I'm going to push back against that. I mean, in advance of it, nobody expected it to be over 40%. A lot of people feared it could be well below 35%. And so 44% by that standard is, of course, it's you know, you would want a higher turnout. But in comparison with other similar referendums,
more than half the people didn't bother at all. Do you know? So you would question how much they care about the outcome, or about the thing in the first place, and how it would actually impact on future votes they might participate in, I suppose.
Yeah, I remember speaking to someone in government in the days before the referendum, and I said, be honest now, what would you consider a good turnout? And they actually said, oh, in my heart of hearts, and they were scared to even say it, like above 40, like, oh. And that's what happened. So actually, it's kind of in line with their wildest dreams that they got around 40. They didn't expect that at all.
Yeah, I mean,
it's ironic though that they thought over 40 would seal the deal for them, or would
they
help.
They did.
You
they
know?
Thought a lower turnout would. Oh God, they were so
we
wrong.
We did an extensive podcast on this subject on Wednesday, so I don't want to kind of go back over some of that ground. But it is still Jack Horgan-Jones was saying on Wednesday that there was shock at the not at the result but at the margin. About the number of people who voted no, particularly on care. You can understand the care because there was a sort of a pincer movement and the kind of Progressive Alliance fractured over it and all that kind of stuff. But it was a big no for the first big national vote that this government has had to undergo since its election more than 4 years ago. And that has to cause ripples of unease, along with a sense that they made a hames of the thing. So perhaps, you know, to be some question of confidence in their own in their own political skills, wouldn't there?
Yeah, I heard Jack's contribution on Wednesday's podcast. Very interesting. And I think he was spot on, because in the media aftermath of anything, you know, the question does get asked of political journalists or whatever, what does this mean? Sometimes it can be hard to discern the level of fallout. And I think it's not even that it threatens the inner stability of the coalition. And the government is buoyed somewhat by the fact that the opposition voted. They were bar Aintu, obviously, and independents, some independents. So be that as it may, I think the real problem is the scale of the no votes, with the fact that so many people voted no. The worry in government now is there an underlying trend of an anti-establishment, even though the opposition were involved, basically rhetoric, or is there something there that they should be worried about? And one of the interesting ramifications that could happen is the timing of the next general election. So Leo Varadkar was asked in one of his press events in America this week, when are you going to hold the election? Have you given any thought to the date of the election? And he said, not soon anyway. And of course, you know, of course, I think there's many people in government now who go, oh God, it's far too close to even be thinking or talking about a general election when we've just been given the greatest kicking of all time. So I think there's nervousness about, this is the first time the country's gone to the polls for you know, an event like this for in 4 years, maybe somewhere around that. Is there an underlying trend that does not become evident in opinion polls waiting for the government? Are they going to get an even worse kicking? And I think that's the worry for them.
There's nearly 500,000 new voters. It's been such a long time. You know, there's a whole bunch of people under the ages of 23 or 24 who have never voted before. They get their information in a different kinds of ways from different places. I mean, who knows? Well, one thing we do know, and that was mentioned by the political scientists on Wednesday, Cormac, is that the electorate is increasingly volatile. And it can turn on a dime in the space of a few days, you know.
There's very few, you know, traditional Fianna Fáil voters. I vote Fianna Fáil because my dad voted Fianna Fáil, because my grandfather voted Fianna Fáil. That seems to be gone. You know, there is a big question mark over those younger voters. Our opinion polling would suggest a large amount of them will support Sinn Féin. You know, it's often in the high 30s to early 40s percentile range for Sinn Féin. But we'll see, Sinn Féin's star seems to have dimmed just a little bit in the last couple of months. You know, I'm trying to think where the vote's going. You know, maybe the Social Democrats are an avenue for them. People before profit, some of them, you know.
A lot of independents in rural Ireland, I think, even more than we have already. It seems quite possible. And the other kind of fallout from this, I wonder, as some people have suggested, including mutterings in both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, that, you know, some of the remains of the legislative programme of this government, know, maybe should not be prioritised as much as they have been, and they should knuckle down and get back to basics and not be worrying about hate speech bills and various things like that. Is that going on?
There's all this anxiety now, but there's been anxiety about the hate speech bill for ages, and Pat's been covering this a lot. Like, I think Pat's been staying on it, but constantly asking, where is it? And so far, nowhere. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the fact that it was supposed to be last summer when they wanted to get it through, and then it was pushed out to last Christmas, then it was the new year, now we're in the spring, now we're talking about the summer. I think that there's a lot of anxiety in the party about, even though, like, if you look at opinion polls, culture wars, they do tend to, they're right down the bottom. I just wonder, about like, they are.
Yeah, no, they're really minor. And it's not just online, it's not just in Ireland.
Also raises the question, well, why put so much effort into it then, do you know?
But this is more than, I think, a culture war. The hate speech, there's so much. I remember going through the public consultation responses. Now, there were thousands, so I couldn't go through them all, but I flew through as many of them as I could. It's massive opposition to this around the country. And I remember a politician saying to me before, that apart from obviously what happened in Palestine, that whole situation, that the hate speech bill was the highest number of complaints, emails, phone calls to their constituency office and to their Dáil office that they'd ever received, bar the Israel-Palestine conflict. So, that says something, I think.
And given that they're questioning their own political antennae after what happened last week, they might go, well, yeah, have a look at this. But, you know, what's the sensible thing to do?
And then
here?
There's the abortion thing as well. So there was a report last year by Marie O'Shea, the barrister, who recommended widespread changes. We don't need to go into them. We talked about them before. I'm sure we'll talk about them again. Mm. But that's just disappeared. And someone sent me a message the other day giving out to me saying, you should be staying on top of this. And they can rest assured that I have been.
Right. Well, we'll watch all that with interest. We'll take a quick break, then we come back to another issue that's not going to go away at all, which is the question of housing refugees.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. A second mention of Jack Horgan-Jones, who isn't here today, but he has an interesting article in today's Irish Times about the kind of ructions under the surface, or maybe not quite under the surface, that continue at cabinet level about the best way to deal with the real challenge of housing asylum seekers and refugees, Cormac. I mean, he does make a point that the pressure to house Ukrainians has eased slightly because people have moved out of their hotel and B&B accommodation and have found somewhere else to live. But everything else is as tough as ever, if not worse. You look at the situation on Mount Street in Dublin, where there's up to 200 homeless asylum asylum seekers in tents around there. And any solution is not going to be a short-term one.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are living in absolutely shocking conditions. You know, we have rough sleepers and homelessness year round, you know. It's never on the numbers that we're seeing at the moment, and it is a failing. The government have admitted it is a failure of Ireland's obligations to provide for people who are seeking international protection, seeking asylum. It's also the trickier part of the two-streamed immigration issue. There's the 100,000 odd Ukrainians that came here, albeit I think there's only about 80,000 still here. That has always been less controversial. You know, there's been less protests about housing them. There was certainly at the start a great deal of sympathy for them, but then there was the massive increase as well in the number of people seeking actual protection from other countries. I think it's about 25,000 odd at the moment in accommodation, and this is where the protests have been taking place, with kind of, you know, far right tropes of, you know, military age men and you know, unvetted people coming in, and we don't want them in our communities, that all of those kinds of arguments. And Jack has been doing a lot of reporting this week, and talking about how rooms have freed up as Ukrainians leave them, but these haven't necessarily been switched over to rooms for people seeking international protection. It's kind of up to the they're often hotels or private organizations. It's kind of up to them
which group they
take, you know.
Yeah.
There's still pressure on the Ukrainian side as well. The changes whereby Ireland's offering to Ukrainians is less generous than it was. So we have now a 90-day limit on state provided accommodation. We have reduced welfare payments for those who are in state provided accommodation. His story today is about how the Irish Red Cross has warned that this could have an impact on Ireland's rental market as these people have to leave the state provided accommodation.
So this is an interesting point. You have thousands, or possibly tens of thousands of people in this accommodation, and if they're going out into the world, and you know, they may well have got themselves a job and be, you know, everything's going well, but as we know, there's a dire shortage of private rented accommodation for everybody.
Yeah, and there's the issue of the €800 a month support that's available to people that house Ukrainian refugees as well. So does that give an unfair advantage then in comparison to other people who are in the rental market? You know, or does it just mean that the landlord ups the price? You know, there's all sorts of potential questions. Now, you know, the government, I suppose, is hoping that the limit on the state provided accommodation will act as a deterrent to people coming here in the first place, just given the numbers Ireland has accepted at this point. But we won't know
those numbers seem to have slackened since the start of the year, haven't they? And as you say, I think some people have gone back or have left Ireland. So the real tourney and probably the more longer term question is just the much higher number of people seeking international protection here and what to do about them. And there is a long term plan which has been around and which Jack notes is going to probably form part of the next long term plan, which is what Radical Gorman
is a very scaled back long term plan. It was the white paper, then direct provision. Well, there'll be no end to direct provision anytime soon. I would wonder whether they manage it by the end of the decade. You know, it's given the additional numbers that have come in. I mean, it seems to me the only real solution is to build centres around the country, but then you face the problem of local opposition and the cost and how quickly it can be done. We don't want Ireland to take so long to do anything, you know. So it's a big problem, and it's going to be something that features as we get into the local elections.
And the thing that's depressing about it, Jen, reading the reports, is that the implication throughout that there isn't a coherent government approach here, that Rod O'Gorman, who God knows has had enough on his plate over the last while, is just being left to fend for himself too much, and that the other kind of key agencies, I suppose particularly around housing, but other ones as well, you know, have to be dragged screaming to the table to make their contribution.
Yeah, I mean, that has been a point that's been raised over the last couple of months. Now, anytime you ask the relevant ministers, Roderick O'Gorman, Dara O'Brien, they insist like there's no tensions, but I think that is probably untrue. I think like at the start of this week, it was either Monday or Tuesday, it was very early in the week, Éan O'Riordan, Labour TD, went to the makeshift camp. It's around the International Protection Offices in Mount Street. And he took a video which he put on a social media platform, so kind of the situation, the dire situation really, and it's absolutely horrendous, the conditions the people are facing there. That went quite far and wide, I think, and then we had other journalists going down. I know Grip sent somebody down. And what we actually, I just think it exemplifies something about this government and their response to the immigration issue. After these, this outrage started kind of pouring out and people could see with their own eyes what's going on, then we had statements from the government and comments about how basically an extra effort is going to be made to find accommodation. And it just reinforces the view that this government is reactive and not proactive about these things. That when immigration drops off the news agenda for a while, things kind of fall into a stasis and they get worse. And then it comes back to the top of the agenda and people say, look at this, this is absolutely awful. And then they say, oh, we'll absolutely do something about this. In the very least, we'll get them
emergency
accommodation.
Not to be too cynical, though, isn't that very often true of governments?
Yeah, but this is a different kind of topic, really. You're talking about 200 people, you know, not having access to any kind of basic, you know, facilities, you know, their basic human rights. And I just think it says a lot about the government. And the reason why I think that matters is because one of the arguments people make against the government, whether that be online or it could be any of your friends here or my friends or any of our family members, is that this is a government that is out of touch and uncaring. And when you see what played out this week, I think that really, really feeds into that. So there's a longer term thing there. Obviously, the most important issue is the situation, the conditions facing those men. But I think there's a wider optics thing here for the government. The other thing I was interested in was the ambassador, the Ukrainian ambassador, Larissa, hope I don't mispronounce her name, Garasko. She talked about how they would like kind of Ukrainian citizens to return home after the war ends. And it just really made me think of how important a Donald Trump term would be, not only to Irish politics, but politics around the globe, because, you know, it's very much assumed that if he becomes the president again, which is now looking kind of likely, actually, that he would pull support for Ukraine overnight, that would embolden Putin, that Putin would then kind of turn his focus to NATO, and that the kind of pressures that are on individual countries immigration-wise stemming from it will continue. And that has a knock-on implication for Irish politics coming up to the election. I just thought that was... I don't know, I just thought that was an interesting point.
No, that's a very good point, especially as we're looking towards America for this weekend as well. And as you say, Trump is leading in the polls now, although it's a long, long, long way to go.
Yeah.
In terms of what articles we were reading this week that took our fancy on IrishTimes.com, Cormac, you were looking at something, it's referendum related, but it's not really about the referendum. It's
wider. Referendums in general and going back and broader, the oversight, the ethics oversight of politics in general. This was a story by Arthur Beasley during the week on how the SIPO, the Standards and Public Office Commission, has no role in examining spending during a referendum by non-government organisations or so-called third parties that register to participate in referendums and other political campaigns. Basically, these organisations, they register once they've received a donation of over €100. There's all sorts of rules about what kinds of donations they can have. They can't get donations from people abroad, other Irish citizens. There's limits on the amount that they can get. But in terms of the spending of the money, they have no role in examining that. It came up during a referendum campaign where people on the no side were querying the funding, the state funding given to organisations like the National Women's Council, and how, you know, questioning whether this was being used as part of the Yes Yes campaign. Now, the National Women's Council has said, you know, that there's... They have very strict controls on their funding.
They put kind of firewalls around.
They only spend what they fundraise themselves or use unrestricted funds. Now, the counter argument to that is they'd have to fundraise an awful lot more if they didn't get all that state funding.
Yeah.
But aside from that, there's no oversight on how the money is spent or which money is spent by the Standards and Public Office Commission, which is a watchdog, but it's more of a poodle than a Rottweiler, really, when it comes to bark and bite. It often engages in investigations into alleged ethics breaches by politicians and things like that. It has a role in, you know, publishing political party accounts and donation statements, albeit the information provided in those is minimal. There is a level of transparency, but the description of how things are spent by political parties is often fairly vague. But it itself has every year in its annual reports talks about, you know, additional powers it should have.
Been looking for those for more than a decade
years,
been ignored by.
So it's a pet peeve of mine, which is why I picked that article. But
that's good. We always like to vent pet peeves. My piece is very different from that. It's from Derek Scally, our correspondent in Berlin, and it's about the Zone of Interest. The Oscars took place last Sunday, and The Zone of Interest, which is an extraordinary film set in Auschwitz, won two awards, I think, Best International Film and Best Sound. The sound is amazing in it. If you haven't seen it, I don't know if you've seen it, it's very disturbing. It's a very banal portrait of a German family, you know, and their children playing in the garden and cleaning the house and all this kind of stuff. But the father is the commandant of Auschwitz, and you see nothing of what's happening in the camp, but you can hear it because just on the other side of the wall. It's a really powerful, disturbing kind of a film. But what was great about Derek's piece was it made me think again in a completely different way about the film, because it's only been released in Germany last week, and it's in German, although the director is British, Jonathan Glazer. And the reaction, I think, was very different in Germany. And one of the reasons, I think there were a number of different reasons, was that I obviously watched it with subtitles. I'm not a native German speaker, and so I could understand everything that was going on, but the sound is so complex and mixed up that German audiences couldn't see that because they didn't need the subtitles. So people were actually going to see the film you could go and see them with the English subtitles in order to exactly figure out what was going on. But it was a sign to me again of how valuable it is to have people like, you know, Derek in Berlin and Naomi in Brussels and Keith in Washington and all the rest of them to kind of be our eyes and ears for the world.
I thought it was funny how he found Irish people watching the film in Germany as well.
He did.
But there was very complicated reactions from the German audience, wasn't it? There was kind of layers of nuance and
because, you know, I mean, Germans obviously have thought an awful lot more about these questions of responsibility and guilt and all those kinds of things than we have. Although I think the film itself is about more than just, ultimately about more than just the German experience. And when Glazer was getting his Oscar, he was making that very point about Gaza.
Yeah. What way has it landed overall? Is it overall panned in Germany now?
No. What you would call a mixed response, ranging from enthusiastic to some people who had big problems with the film and thought it was kind of glib. And we're familiar with that ourselves, aren't we? When you see a film made about Irish history, by somebody who isn't necessarily Irish, very often people think it's simplified or sentimentalized or that. And that's a valid point of view too. What's your article?
I went for an article that we do mention Finn McGredman's articles a lot. I think her writing is brilliant. I don't always agree with everything she writes, but she has a way of writing and she picks really interesting topics. And this week she was writing about the Royals' woes. So I don't know whether you've been following this Kate Middleton issue. I've tried so many times not to get sucked in, but
not to think about the Royals, but it was impossible this week.
Once you go down this rabbit hole, you don't.
This thing is fascinating.
So, you know, she obviously had her abdominal surgery. She wasn't supposed to be back to royal duties until Easter. Then there was all these conspiracy theories online. I mean, so some of them were mad. One of them was like, she's dead. The other one was like, maybe she's just setting a boundary. I mean, you know, to like running in the European election, like literally you name it, and it was online. And these were all just conspiracy theories until she released the photo on Mother's Day of her and her kids. And it turns out that all the major photo agencies had to issue a kill notice, which is very rare. You're talking kind of, you know, Korea territory here, but like it's very rare that they would do that. And then it led to this, why did she edit it? Anyway, at Finn's piece, she's talking.
So just they for the 1% of the population who don't know about this, they withdrew the photograph because they realized that the photograph had been digitally altered and tampered with.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at it, there are like parts of the sleeve of, I think Princess Charlotte is missing, and all, you know, there's a lot of like blurry parts, and it does look weird. First time I saw it, I said, it just looks weird. But in her piece, Finn is writing that the royal family are behaving more like celebrities and less like royals. Tell-all memoirs, interviews and Photoshop, and how this is kind of chipping away at the royal institution. I just think the whole story is absolutely fascinating. And for anybody who hasn't fallen down the rabbit hole, if you even Google Kate Middleton, you will disappear into the internet for around 45
minutes. It was such an
incredibly
dim thing to do, given, as you say, all those conspiracy theories that were floating around the place. And the excuse was, oh, I always do this, as lots of people do, you know, you can do it so easily now. But there's no way she did that. It was some chinless wonder in the PR department who decided it would look better
unwell.
Like that.
Apparently, you know? She's very chinless wonder. Stealing that. Apparently she is very unwell. So if I was very unwell after a surgery, you wouldn't find me sitting down for a spot of Photoshop.
No.
Do you know?
No. So there's no way it was her. Yeah,
I think they're refusing to release the original photo as well.
What struck me
about it was, it was such a perfect picture. All the kids were looking at the camera. They're all smiling or laughing.
That never happens.
It's impossible. It's like they're herding a group of cats or whatever, trying to get kids to look at the camera at the same time and smile. So it was too good to be true. It was a lovely picture, but it's not true.
You know what it probably is? Realistically, she probably is very unwell. She probably didn't look great in the picture, and she got one member of her staff fixed that up a little bit, not thinking, You know, I think that's what it is. She's just been unwell.
Yeah.
I mean, there's loads of other conspiracy theories.
I absolutely believe it's an innocent explanation or like trying to get just a picture with all the kids smiling. And you know, it's something like...
The lesson I take from it is that Kate Middleton's entrance into the royal family hasn't improved the overall IQ of the royal family, which wasn't that high to begin with, making a mistake like that. On that ungenerous note, ungenerous and Republican note, we will leave it there. Thanks very much to Cormac and to Jen and to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Verno. We'll be back after the weekend. Have a great bank holiday weekend. See you then.